It's that time again. We're focusing on the Middle East, North Africa region, and we'll be joining Dr. Harry Hagopian, our studio guest, who is our analyst on that region, who is always in and out of the Middle East, North Africa. So who better to start off this Middle East analysis? You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis. Now, I'm always on my knees grovelling for forgiveness from you, dear listeners, because it has been nearly 4 weeks since our last Middle East Analysis, and we have committed to bringing you something every fortnight. So, yes, apologies, we are a little late on it, but as I say, I am opposite Dr. Harry Hagopian, Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, international lawyer, former Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches, something I haven't actually mentioned in the intro, Harry, for some time, but I think it pertinent. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and much as you said you would like to grovel because we haven't done a podcast for a long time, and I agree with you, but let me say two things on that, James. One, the nature of our podcast is very interesting. We don't do news. We don't do too much in-depth analysis. We do commentary on political and ecumenical and church issues. So I think to some extent it works, given my busy schedule and yours. And knowing you a little bit, because offline we're friends, it is quite obvious to me that you are also burdened with a lot of responsibilities. So I do appreciate the time you carve out for those MENA podcasts.
Oh, it's a loving. Myself as well, Harry. I've been in Italy. You're in and out of the region all the time.
Absolutely. And I was even in Dublin, which was a different, completely different tack, where I delivered a lecture on the Armenian genocide, not only in terms of the history, because everybody has been doing it for 98 years, but I sort of put forth challenges, not only to the Turks, but to the Armenians as well, as to how they should think out of the box and move forward in terms of dealing with what has been a cruel chapter in Armenian history and the first genocide of the 20th century as well. So it was lovely being in a church in Dublin, St. Werburgh's, and having different church representatives there, as well as people from Ireland and the Armenian community. And the response at the end of the talk by the Primate of Ireland was really uplifting.
Now, I like you, Harry, because you've got this sense of continuity. You've just picked up where we left off on the last podcast.
Absolutely.
Very good. Now, on a serious note now, I do want to pick up, because how can you not, on the country of Syria, obviously.
Indeed.
Now, since we last spoke, there have been all sorts, and we're always lamenting the pain of on looking, really, to that situation, the bloodshed, the allegations, as they are, of sarin or nerve agents being used, Obama using his rhetoric, of course, of that being the red line for America, mm-hmm. if there are chemical weapons usages. Secretary of State John Kerry meeting Vladimir Putin, and we'll talk about that, the sort of East and West mentality towards, and in fact, extending that to the international community towards what's going on in Syria. Now, I often throw my arms up to you as the non-expert and say, Harry, crikey, what is going on? It's like this all the time. Where is progress happening? Is there any progress to this? Can we see any sort of light at the end of this very bleak tunnel?
Blimey, you said crikey, I'll say blimey, James. I mean, you have thrown in so many issues in that question of yours that we could be here for a couple of hours, and I don't think you have the time, I have the time, nor would our listeners have the patience for it.
All right, let me drill down a bit, because I think that's only fair. Picking up on Kerry and Putin, picking up on Russia and America, England, William Hague, we're kind of in the middle a bit. Is the international community still reticent as a whole to do anything about the crisis in Syria?
I think the international community is still reticent. I think the American administration, the U.S. administration, and particularly not only the administration, because there are differences of opinion within the U.S. administration, but President Obama himself, I think, who keeps changing the rules of the game, who keeps shifting that red line he self-defines, is not at all in the mood to become more actively involved with the Syria situation. And there are many, many reasons for this. One reason clearly, and our listeners would be aware of it, is the fact that with Afghanistan and Iraq still very much fresh in American memories, Obama has been elected as the president who would get America out of foreign wars, not into foreign wars. And therefore, the fact that he's basically come out of Iraq, the fact that Afghanistan is very much heading in that direction as well, he does not want to have as his legacy the president who entered into another war in Syria, a neighbor of Iraq, incidentally, and whose consequences are anybody's guess at the moment if the Americans or anybody were to try and go in any form or shape, whether it's airstrikes, whether it's humanitarian corridors or no-fly zones, whether it is even boots on the ground, which of course is highly unlikely. That's one reason for it. The other is, I think, that the American public and the American economy do not yet allow for such a big foreign adventure. At the moment, America is very introspective. America is very much looking inward. We had the Oklahoma hurricane only a couple of days ago, and I was listening to President Obama, and it was very interesting because you could pick up the vibes when he was saying that, you know, it is time for us to look at our own issues now. It was almost as if he were saying, I'm not going to be waylaid by more foreign policy issues. So there's that factor as well, James. But one determining factor, in my opinion, that President Obama thinks should deter him from doing anything in Syria at the moment is the fact that the situation on the ground is so unclear in Syria. And there are, of course, lots of foreign jihadists fighting with the rebels against the regime. There are too many radical groups which are fighting there. And I think in the political imagination of the West, which retains a combination of savvy experience with ridiculous naivete when it comes to politics, they think that if we go and assist the rebels and those people then take over and President Bashar al-Assad is no longer there, then it might actually be worse for us than it is at the moment. So it's a very cruel realpolitik principle being applied where almost, and I'm paraphrasing here something one Israeli official said when he was trying to be drawn out into what does Israel want to come out of Syria. The devil you know better than the devil you don't.
Well, funnily enough, I was going to tweet you a cartoon I saw from an American magazine, I believe, or American newspaper, forgive me for not remembering which had Obama and then a series of colourful lines, the first one being red, saying, if you do this, then it's crossing the red line. And then it was sort of like, you know, allegations of chemical use. Well, if you do that, you're crossing the purple line. And then it had a load of lines. So he's shifting a bit.
Absolutely, he is shifting, and he's shifting more than a bit. He's shifting so much that at the moment, the Syrian regime would probably feel quite comfortable knowing that with the support they've got from Russia, which is quite clear, the support they've got from Iran, which is equally clear, and the news we get about forces or militias from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon also assisting in the fighting, particularly near the Lebanese border in Al-Qusayr, all this would indicate to me that they are feeling quite comfortable because they don't think that Obama is going to do anything. And of course, we hear our Prime Minister David Cameron and the President of France, François Hollande, both want to do something. They want to lift the sanctions on arming the rebels that the EU has imposed upon itself. But all that is coming under pressure because the Americans don't want to do anything that, in their opinion, would exacerbate the situation, ridiculously enough, more than it is already.
I'm going to just chance my arm a bit here. Mm. If the international community, I'm not saying boots on the ground, but had got more involved, more proactive earlier, do you think that would have done anything to our anxiety that if we do now arm the rebels or, I don't know, give them further equipment and protection, whatever it might be, Are we not arming separatist groups and all kinds of factions? We now can't define who the rebels are, can we?
Spot on. I mean, you've basically put your finger on the key issue here. Let me answer you in two ways, because I think there is another important factor about this red line that you referred to, that President Obama talks about and that you wanted to tweet to me. The irony of that red line is that the message it sends is not the buck stops here, but that anything you do until you get to that red line is fine. In other words, the red line is synonymous with chemical weapons, which means so long as you don't use chemical weapons, you can use as many MiG aircraft or Scud missiles or strafe areas of the country. That is fine with us in the sense that we're not going to intervene. So the deterrent factor, which plays hugely in the psychology of international politics, is no longer there, because we've already boxed ourselves into a situation where we've said what our minimalist expectations are. And then, not only that, but we go on and continue to shift that red line as well. So it becomes even more blurred and less certain. That's on the one hand. The other thing that I would say is that if I were President Bashar al-Assad now, I would realize that there is a growing consensus within parts of the international community that those jihadis who are coming from abroad, whether from Tunisia, from Jordan, from other parts of the MENA region and further afield, those who are fighting there reportedly from Iran or from Hezbollah or from other factors, I'm sure the opposite side also has its own takfiris and jihadis fighting as well with those suicide bombs, etc. The situation is so bad and tenuous at the moment, untenable, that it really makes people think, where are we going? If Syria implodes, that's one problem. If Syria explodes, that's even a bigger problem for the whole region. And that brings me back to the point you made, James, which is that one of the biggest, in my opinion, the biggest strategic errors we in the West committed is that we got swayed to some extent by the fact that it happened relatively quickly and relatively easily in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, to some extent in Yemen, that we thought, yes, this is going to take a few months and then that will be the end of it. President Bashar al-Assad will be toppled. Whereas we did not factor into our political calculations the fact that the Ba'ath regime has been rooted into the system in Syria for over 40 years, that from father to son, they've learned a trick or two about divide and rule, and that it's not going to be that easy. And the longer we have shilly-shallied, the longer we've dilly-dallied, the longer we've dragged our feet before doing anything and always using Russia, the United Nations Security Council, China, or what have you as an excuse not to do something because, incidentally, we didn't want to do something from the beginning, has resulted in a radicalization of the situation that even if now, in all good faith, we do want to do something, it is remarkably more complicated than it would have been a year or more ago.
Do you know, I'm not an expert at all, but I read and I try and keep very well versed on the situation. Mm. And it's funny you mention that. I think we're getting more and more in tune, because I was thinking about the whole point of de-Ba'athification.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned about Iraq and mistakes made, you know, mm-hmm. terrible mistakes, really, that have left a very bad legacy. We have, haven't we? We've created something that is now so hard to define, we can't really get behind it.
We have created something very hazy, very difficult to define. But what
by
we
non-intervention?
By not intervening. And intervening does not necessarily mean what Senator McCain thinks intervention means. We're not talking about boots on the ground. Mm. I'm against that, incidentally. We're not even necessarily talking about no-fly zones or humanitarian corridors, because I'm not necessarily supportive of that either.
Mm.
And the reason I'm not is not so much because the concept is very sexy and very attractive, that you actually provide a no-fly zone, that you actually open up a corridor where humanitarian assistance would flow in for those hundreds of thousands upon millions now of refugees inside the country internally displaced or outside the country, largely in neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey being the prime examples. But I wouldn't do it because the idea is very nice, but for you to enforce that humanitarian corridor or the no-fly zone means that you have to use your military muscle and potential to neutralize the air capacity of the Syrian army, their rockets, their missiles, their MiGs, what have you, so that they do not challenge those corridors and no-fly zones. And the whole concept of the West, particularly of the Obama administration, is predicated on the fact we don't want to have casualties. We don't want to have wounded people coming back on CNN being seen by the Americans who are war-weary anyway after so long and who are much more interested now in what's happening to their own economy, to their welfare system, to their immigration bill, to the natural disasters in the country than they are in supporting something that is happening so far away, which incidentally, and this would move the Americans, if this were the clear-cut wish of Israel to have the removal of Bashar al-Assad, Americans would probably, because we know what American foreign policy is like, they would have supported us in the UK and in France to sort of ramp up the pressure on the regime a bit. But because, in my opinion, Israel is not that keen to get rid of Assad because it's not sure what would replace the Assad regime, is that the Americans do not feel any pressure really except the moral pressure, and moral pressure does not necessarily lead to moral politics.
Now, I am going to ask you about the neighbours that you mentioned, actually, Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan and so forth, probably particularly Lebanon. But before I do that, I was going to ask you, be a little bit bold and say, well, I thought maybe you would be in favour of a no-fly zone or a corridor of humanitarian aid or something like that. And that piqued my interest a bit. So even though that particular window of opportunity of intervention may have passed, would you advocate any sort of intervention now?
Well, it is very difficult, and this is part of the impotence of a lot of politicians and analysts as to we know what is happening, we know what the reality is on the ground, but day in, day out, we find less and less solutions as to how to deal with it. And I'll give you an example on that. The whole, until October, November 2012, like 6 months ago, roughly, the rebels were winning the war on the ground. There were many, many serious reversals by the military, the Syrian army. And people were thinking, okay, people were loudly saying, we never said it, incidentally, James, we always were careful about how to define what is happening in Syria. But a lot of well-known analysts were already saying this is the demise of the regime, that's the end of it, new system is going to come in. Come October, November, say end of the year, gradually, perhaps because of Russian and Iranian advice or perhaps because the conditions on the ground changed, the strategy of the Syrians, and this is borne out by the fighting in Al-Qusayr as we speak now, and it is absolutely horrific, is that it has changed. Whilst before the Syrian army was trying to go everywhere where the rebels were attacking in order to retake the territory, in order to have a presence there, they have now decided they're not going to do that. They're going to focus their military might on the western niche of Syria. Why? Because if any of our listeners looks at the map of Syria, you see key cities there. You see Damascus, you go further up, you see Homs, you see Aleppo, you see Idlib, and you go up to the border. What is behind those lines? Behind those lines is the Mediterranean. Before the Mediterranean is the Alawite community at its densest, at its most numerous. And President Assad hails from that community, which is called either Alawite or Nasseri community. Now, what is happening, I think, is that the strategy has changed so that if they can manage to secure a road, a link between those key cities, which is why Qusair is very important for Homs. Homs is very important as an outlet from Damascus onto the sea. This is what they're doing now. And this frightens me even more in some sense, because one other thing I'm against, which is also being reported in much of the political media and in magazines as respectable as foreign policy, for instance, that this is going to lead to a division or a cantonization or a fragmentation of Syria, where at best the regime would have a little pocket where it and its community would stay. And incidentally enough, that would have the Mediterranean Sea, that would have a direct link to Lebanon, that would secure the link for Iran to continue its influence over the MENA region, and the rest of the country would probably be divided between the Kurds in the north, which pretty much have their autonomy now already, and the Sunnis, who have been battling the regime out, have other parts of the country, with the smaller communities, including Christians, pretty much dispersed here, there, and everywhere, hence their fears, hence the whole issue of the two abducted bishops and other priests who were abducted, a Greek Orthodox and an Armenian Catholic, who have made so much echo across international news agencies. This, in a sense, reflects to you how hairy the situation is, how volatile the situation is, and how it could go any way, anywhere, which is why at this stage, Foreign Minister of Russia Sergei Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry coming together and saying, let's revive the Geneva document of June 2012, call it Geneva 2, get all sides together to talk, is going to be a Herculean task. I wouldn't call it a Sisyphean task, because who knows, with the aid of whatever, it might just happen, but I have my serious doubts that at this late stage, it's going to be possible to get together a regime that now is believing more and more that it is beginning to regain the upper hand, and the rebels and the opposition, who are as divided, if not more divided than they were before, with less arms reaching them, so they don't have the clout to speak through their guns. I think we're in a very, very difficult situation in Syria, and it pains me to see a country whose civilization and whose worth is being ripped apart in this way.
And if you are a regime supporter, looking at the ever-dissolving unilateral solutions, you would be quite pleased, wouldn't you?
You would, because basically anything that does not seek clarity or lead to clarity is in the interest of the regime, because eventually it means that the regime would prevail. Now, I'm not going so far as to say personally, and I have not said it, whether in my writings, in my interviews, and certainly not in my tweets, as you sometimes refer to them, that the regime is there to stay or the Syrian national opposition is gone. They do have a very big role to play. What I'm trying to underline is that there is a huge mess in the country, and part of that mess is because we allowed it to go on for so long.
Harry, we mentioned the neighbours, and I'll give you a chance to talk about that, although you already have, so that's up to you. We were, of course, going to touch upon the situation with the two Orthodox bishops that you did mention earlier, and the situation, because there was a bit of a false dawn in that some information came to light that they'd been released, or at least in a safe house.
Indeed, and they haven't been released. In fact, most people, and I do say most people, do not know where they're being held, but the impression I get, the reports I get, is that they're still well treated, so thank God to that. But they're not the only two people. I mean, what happened a few days ago, just to put a bracket there, James, the Latin Rite Catholic Archbishop of Jordan, of Amman, Archbishop Marun Laham, led a vigil across the streets of Jordan in order to try and seek the release of those two bishops. And I sent him an email message in which I said that I share your prayers, Bishop, for the release of those two abducted bishops, who one of them, incidentally, is the brother of the patriarch of the Greek Orthodox community of Antioch, in other words, the Arab Orthodox community. And the other one is somebody who's been on the ecumenical and religious scene for decades already. And the fear for him, and this is a bit of a detail, is that he's diabetic. So people are hoping that he's actually getting his insulin and that he's still okay. But I told the Archbishop in Jordan, as I tell my listeners now, much as I feel for those two bishops, I know that there are over 80,000 people dead. I know that there are refugees of more than 1.5 million. I know the internally displaced and the destruction on both sides, the pain, the bitterness. So two people are important. But let us not be too faith-centric as Christians. Let us not just keep singling out the Christians and get ourselves in a tizzy when we hear that a Christian has died or a Christian has been abducted, and not really care that much when a non-Christian, be he or she, member of the Druze, Kurdish, Sunni, Shi'i community being killed. They're all human beings and they are all suffering together. Syria is suffering, so let's not add to the sectarianism more than it already is on the ground at the moment.
Hear, hear. They're all our brothers and sisters. Certainly would pay to remember that. Harry, I'm going to offer you a final thought. Before I do, I'm going to say you can catch Dr. Harry Hagopian on Twitter, as he has alluded to, at Harry Hagopian. The church, we are on Twitter at Catholic EW, so please follow us as well. Harry, final thought. Now, again, it kind of escaped our listeners that you are an Armenian, so I think you've got a slight vested interest in this final story, but talk to us about an interesting enthronement next month.
Indeed, and you know what, James, you've done this beautifully today in the podcast because you allowed me to start with an Armenian angle and you're allowing me to end on an Armenian upbeat note.
We allow that for our quality spokespeople.
Thank you. The beginning, the intro, was a rather gloomy chapter in Armenian history, the genocide, but the end would be very upbeat because one of the things that is happening in that beautiful holy city of Jerusalem that the prophet Zechariah calls the golden city in the Old Testament, there is an Armenian community there, as well as many other communities, Christian or Muslim or Jewish. And the Armenian community has elected a new leader, a new archbishop. We call them a patriarch, like a supreme religious leader for that community. His name is Archbishop Norhan Manugyan, and he's going to be enthroned. In other words, he's officially going to sit on his patriarchal see on the 5th of June. In other words, in about a couple of weeks' time, roughly. And it's going to be quite an event, and I'm sure that other churches, the Catholic Church, the Orthodox churches, all the other churches are going to participate in this joyous moment. He's a good leader. He's what the Armenian community needs now, somebody who is solid but also compassionate.
Would he be addressed as His Beatitude?
He would be addressed as His Beatitude.
Can we get His Beatitude in the studio?
Well, it's a bit difficult unless you manage to fly him out of Jerusalem and put him here in this tiny little studio. It might be a little bit too downbeat for a patriarch.
It's not grand enough,
James. But what I do know also is that I had the pleasure of having a conversation with the General Secretary of our own, or your Conference of Catholic Bishops here in London yesterday, and I was discussing this enthronement with Monsignor Marcus Stock, and he said that a letter of congratulations will be going out from the conference to the new patriarch-elect in Jerusalem. So that, for me, is one of the symbolic signs of ecumenism. But I guess we've got to start somewhere.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, thanks ever so much. I know you're in and out of the country and always very busy with legal activities, consultancy and everything else, but you are a true expert. And for that, I thank you for your time.
My pleasure, James.
That's it for this Middle East analysis. I know we're rapidly approaching our 30-minute threshold, so thank you ever so much for listening to us. At Catholic EW, one final plug. At Harry Hagopian, another plug for Harry. And do join us in the coming weeks for the next Middle East analysis.